Thanks for tuning in to the Lean 911 podcast, where you'll have a voice directly from the Gemba. I will rely on my 3 decades of Lean successes, as well as my failures, to answer your most challenging questions regarding your Lean transformation. I'm your host, Mark DeLuzio, President and CEO of Lean Horizons Consulting, and the principal architect of the Danaher Business System. Looking forward to your questions. Now, let's go to the Gemba. Hi, welcome to episode 12, Accounting for Lean. My name is Mark DeLuzio, President and CEO of Lean Horizons Consulting, and you're listening to the Lean 911 podcast. I'm also the principal architect of the Danaher Business System, and I'm going to talk about something that I was involved with and actually created back in 1989. At the company called Jake Brake, which started the whole evolution of the Danaher Business System itself. And that's under, you know, George Konigsaker was the president, who I worked for, and Art Byrne, who George worked for Art. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about what we did with the accounting process when I was his CFO, George's CFO. Now, episode 11 talked about lean accounting. This episode's going to talk about accounting for lean. So if you're watching this on YouTube, I'm going to share my screen and actually bring up the presentation. But don't worry, if you're just listening on the podcast, you won't miss a beat. Don't worry. So anyway, accounting for lean and lean accounting. So I want to walk through a case study, just like I did last time on lean accounting, for an accounting for lean case study. And this is the actual Jake Brake case study. And this is really what got the whole notion of accounting for lean off the ground. I believe I was the first one to do this, and many others followed. Wiremold followed. When Art Byrne went to Wiremold after Danaher, he had his CFO call me to benchmark us, and many other companies after that followed suit. So this was the inaugural lean accounting or accounting for lean process that we created back in 1989. And again, let's just go through some basic definitions. I did these last time on episode 11, but lean accounting is just taking the lean methodologies and concepts and tools to drive out waste in the accounting process itself, whether it's accounts payable, that's the example I used last time, accounts receivable, payroll, closing, all these things are wrought with the same waste that you find on the shop floor. They're just a little bit tougher to see because they are hidden sometimes, right? It's not as easy to see waste in a office environment as it is to see when you're making widgets every single day. Okay, but this episode is going to talk about accounting for lean. So modifying the accounting process and internal management reporting to properly deliver financial and operational information, which promotes lean behaviors. That's the real key, right? So many of our accounting systems today drive the wrong behaviors. And I've still today are talking to accountants who say, we're trying to optimize the capacity of that equipment. We're trying to drive efficiency to standard, although the standards are 10 years old, you know, that type of thing. So it's a big waste of time and just driving the wrong behaviors. And we'll talk more about these as we move through. Okay. I talked about the lean accounting benefits last time, taking waste out of the accounting process, more timely information, better quality, and all this stuff. And bottom line is, this was part and parcel to drive the position of the accounting group in a company to be navigators rather than historians. We want to use the accounting folks to be able to really drive proactive thinking when it came to the business. Well, you can't do that when it takes 3 weeks to close the books and you have all kinds of errors in accounts payable and payroll problems are abounding. You can't just do that. You are too busy fighting fires all the time. So in episode 11, I just used accounts payable, archaic as it was back then in 1989, to show how we drove waste out of the accounting process itself, the accounts payable process itself. Okay. This is important because if you don't get this one right, you're not going to be able to move on to some of the stuff I'm going to talk about next, which is, again, accounting for lean. Okay, what are the benefits? I'm going to talk specifically about dysfunctional behaviors, building unnecessary inventory, long production runs, batch and queue production, right? less changeovers. We want to do more changeovers, right? On lean decisions, capital decisions. I have a whole podcast I've done. I forget which episode it was, but it's, if you look it up on Lean 911, the whole podcast is dedicated to how I looked at capital appropriation requests for equipment from a lean perspective. Not just from a strict bean counter perspective, like most accountants do. I dove real deep into that. So that was a big part of this, okay? I won't spend a lot of time on it this time because you go back to that podcast and get more detail. More accurate financial information, driving, getting away from this overarching allocation of overhead and spreading that like peanut butter across the company, which led to more accurate product cost at the cell level, not only at the value stream level, but at the cell level, okay? Cost data wasn't arbitrary. People finally understood what was in their numbers, which is really neat. So the case study I want to talk about is accounting for lean. How do we look at our lean accounting systems relative to lean thinking, right, that we knew at the time, right? It's interesting. Ono said, costs do not exist to be calculated. They exist to be reduced. Interesting. So many times the accountants spend all their time fundamentally tracking, reconciling to the penny, making sure this report balances that. They're not doing anything. All they're doing is a lot of busy work, which, you know, at the end of the day, doesn't really add any value to the business. So we have to rethink that whole function as to how it could be, again, a navigator, not a bunch of historians telling you stuff that happened, 3 to 4 weeks ago, which is not helpful at all. Okay. So our situation analysis at Jakebrick at the time, we were a traditional batch and queue. We had departments everywhere. We had, a machining department, an assembly department, a testing department, a components department, a heat treat. We had everything in batch operations. And as we moved these operations into a one-piece flow by value stream and by cell, in our business, we center this around customers, okay? We had major OEM customers like Cummins and Caterpillar and Detroit Diesel, Mack Truck, all those major customers. We were able to drive a flow and not these big batch departments with one big stock room that fundamentally everything went in and out, in and out, in and out. It was a big waste of time, and it had all the waste associated with inventory and movement and transportation and quality and all that good stuff, right? So you'll see some numbers at the end because I show Jakebrick's 10-year numbers, and you'll see what I'm talking about. We had MRP-driven work orders. We got rid of that. Our work order was the cell. We didn't need a work order for every single operation. By the way, when I shut off the MRP system, people went ballistic, but it was the right thing to do. Absorption costing promoted building of unnecessary inventory, right? Overhead applied on direct labor hours, which made no sense at all to anything except for it was nice and convenient for the accountants. Variance analysis, we didn't analyze anything. All we did is try to figure out why the standard was wrong and why we didn't have a problem. We had a lot of problems, but the accounting system wasn't revealing those problems. Inaccurate inventory records, and they were meaningless. Labor reporting, unbelievable, exhaustive labor reporting. High volume of inventory and labor transactions, inaccurate product costing. All these things were essentially one big ball of waste, and it added very little value to the business, if it did at all. Actually, it took away more than it added, okay? So we had to address this. Now, at this point, I had, 7 years of pretty darn good traditional cost accounting experience in manufacturing. I worked for a guy at Lego Systems, the toy company, who I thought was a world-class cost accountant. And I also worked with somebody really good at Ensign Bickford, which was we made blasting products and some other businesses as well. I mean, I really knew cost accounting. And in order for this to happen, I had to undo everything that I learned and challenge everything. And once I understood the principles involved with lean, it all made sense. So many accountants say they understand, but they don't. And they'll hold on to their standard costs like they'll hold on to their Bible. And they will not give standard costing up because they don't see the damage it does, They don't really understand what lean is all about. And they are very super uber conservative in terms of trying to track every single nickel and dime. And they forget the fact that your management accounting, and this is probably the biggest lesson you'll get out of this, your management accounting, your internal accounting that you use to run the business, you can't do it with a profit and loss statement and a balance sheet and a cash flow statement. These statements are nice to have, but they're useless in terms of running the business, right? And these accountants that I meet, and I meet them all the time, even today in 2023, can't let go of 1970s thinking. They can't let go of this. So the thing they don't understand is that your management accounting system, and here's the lesson, does not have to comply to anything. It doesn't have to apply to GAAP, financial accounting standards, Sarbanes-Oxley. I mean, go down a list of regulations that the government puts on us. It doesn't have to comply to any of that. Now, your external financial reporting, yeah, sure, there's standards. There's a certain way you have to put together a P&L and a balance sheet and a cash flow and certain accounting principles when it comes to reserves and how you amortize things and how you depreciate things. Yeah, all that has to be in accordance with external regulatory standards. Got that. No problem. But your internal reports could be on the back of a napkin if that works for you. All right. Obviously, you wouldn't put it on the back of a napkin, but I'm just trying to make the point that the problem we have is that accountants try to control the business using external financial reports that are really meant for Wall Street or for investors or for banks. You can't manage a company that way, okay? And they don't see the difference, and they don't see the damage they're doing to the internal folks who are trying to run the business using the garbage, quite frankly, that they put out. I hate to be so frank about it, but it's garbage. And I was one of those guys, by the way, okay, until I really understood or started understanding what lean was all about. All right. So my message to the people out here who are listening to this from a financial perspective or in a financial role is to really challenge the behaviors that you're driving in accordance with lean principles. And if you don't understand what I'm talking about, then you don't know lean principles and you have to learn those principles, okay? Because the finance group can make or break a lean transformation. Absolutely make or break, all right? There's more about that, but I'll move on. Okay, first thing we did was we developed value stream costing, all right? So we were able to organize our business by customer. Like I said to you earlier, Detroit Diesel, Cummins Engine, Caterpillar. And in those value streams, we had individual cells. So we eliminated these individual departmental work orders. Now, you have to understand that you can't do accounting for lean until your company transforms. So I actually had a call from a CFO of a company in Florida who wanted me to come out and help them put in accounting for lean. And I asked like three questions and knew already they weren't ready. They had not done, they're still departmentalized. They haven't moved to value streams. They're still driving everything with work orders and MRP, scheduling each piece of equipment independently. Instead of pulling inventory through the factory, they were pushing it through with this whole MRP thing. They did not go into value streams. They didn't have sales. They didn't do all the fundamentals that needed to happen. And I refused to come in to see them. And they were very upset with me. They said, well, geez, you know, we're giving you a job. You know, we're giving you an assignment. I said, no, it's wrong for you. I'm happy to come in and tell you what you have to do, but it can't just be you. It's got to be your operating people, your president. It's got to be the whole staff to understand how this company has to transform. You can't put in accounting for lean if you haven't first transformed your business into a lean type fashion. So this is a big deal here because a lot of people in the accounting group who do want to do this want to lead with it, and that they can't lead. They have to follow right along with the changes that are being made in the business. So another lesson learned here. So be very careful. I'll talk more about this, but we eliminated arbitrary overhead allocations. You know, I was able to assign direct costs to each value stream and in each cell, and we were able to calculate very accurate product costs. All right. We backflush inventory wall to wall, which basically means we made all the intermediate subassembly levels in the bill of material a phantom, and we blew through those bills right to the raw material. We made two inventory transactions. We received the raw material and we shipped the finished goods. Everything else backflushed. And when initially did this, the CPA audit firm at that time was Arthur Anderson, said, "Well, how are you going to find out what you have in inventory?" I said, "Well, we'll go down and look at it. It's right there in the racks." We didn't have inventory in big warehouses. It was all it was right there at the value stream, at the point of use, right? So we didn't have to do that. And we returned inventory 25, 30 times. I convinced them 2 years in a row not to take physical inventories. Because if we wrote off all of our inventory, it was immaterial to the P&L of the company. That's how low our inventory was. So you want to? By the time I got a report together and showed you what we had in inventory, the inventory we were moving inventory through the factory so fast, it would never be accurate. It would never be up to date. So you want to know what we have? Go down and look at it. It's right there in the rack. It's well labeled, and you can tell what's there, what's supposed to be there, our Kanbans, everything else, right? So we drove most of our overhead costs to the value stream. And there's only a certain amount of overhead costs, and I'll talk about that in a minute, that we couldn't drive. And with that, I used ABC costing. I don't like ABC costing. It's too transactional. But for these few remaining costs that were not worth tracking at the product and sell level, I used ABC. All right. We were in control of our destiny when we did this. Now, this variance, we got rid of standard cost altogether. We didn't care about standard cost anymore. So much time went into developing standard cost, it was absolutely ridiculous. It was criminal. So all these variances here, absorption, machine utilization, that's always a good one, purchase price variance, direct to indirect labor ratio, labor variances, direct labor, overhead variances, all these went away because they all drove the wrong behaviors. Absorption variance, if I made more, it doesn't matter what I made, I'll get credit for it, regardless of what the customer ordered, you know, model A, but I'm going to make B because I don't want to change over. And when I make B and capitalize those costs into inventory, well, guess what? I get production credit for it and I look pretty good. And my P&L looks good, right? Machine utilization. Let's just try to utilize our equipment. I said to a CFO one time, "Hey, by the way, you just bought a brand new Lexus. Are you going to drive that around the block tonight 1,000 times to get utilization out of it?" He goes, "No, why would I do that? Why would you do that? You're doing it here. You're putting everybody on a bonus plan to keep their equipment up. So they're not changing over. They're building inventory you can't sell. You're losing customers because you're not delivering. And you're not doing PM, just basic PM, never mind TPM. You're not doing basic preventive maintenance, and your equipment's breaking down anyway. It's driving all the wrong things." So if your tech time says that you have to make one unit, well, let's just say your demand says that you have to make, you know, 60 units an hour, so your tech time would be 1 minute. Why do I want to make 100? I remember when Shihiro Nakao from Shingijitsu came in and said, "You guys got to slow that machine down. It's producing too fast." And we looked at him like he had three heads. "What are you talking about?" "Well, your tech time is this, and you're producing that at this speed. You're producing too fast. You're building too much inventory." Now, it's nice you have that extra utilization. Go get the sales guys to sell more product, and we'll put that product on it, and then you'll be fine. Up till now, don't build unnecessary inventory. That's what that one did. And so did absorption, by the way. Purchase price variance. We came up with a whole supplier index, of which cost was only one component of it. But, you know, we want to understand how these suppliers work with their design teams and what their lead times were, what their quality was, what their responsiveness and service was. All this stuff was important. We weren't looking at that. The purchase price variance, our purchasing guys basically said, "Hey, I'll buy an extra 10,000 units because I'll get a nickel off and my PPV will look really good, especially at that high volume." Later on, we end up writing it all off as excess inventory, okay? So our quality, no, we're buying inferior quality products. So we got rid of that. Direct to indirect, we got rid of, okay? And again, in accounting, your classical cost accounting courses I took in college and all the way through my career up till this point, indirect was looked at bad, direct was looked at as good. Even in some of the lean thinking value stream things, we think direct labor is value added, and we call that. There's a lot of waste and non-value added in the direct labor operations, not just indirect. And I would argue that, and I like to use analogies, NASCAR or Formula One races or Indy 500. How would you like to get rid of how the driver gets rid of all of his indirect labor? That's his pit crew. Guess what? He loses the race. The job of direct labor operators is to operate. They're not used to go fetch parts. We think we're more productive when we do that. Can you imagine asking the Indy 500 or Formula One driver to change his own tires because you're trying to cut on cost? You think you're more productive that way? No, he's going to lose the race. So the indirect is designed to keep the direct running, and they're as valuable as direct labor. All right, now, there's a whole other notion I think I'm going to do later about value-added and non-value-added, because that is such a misnomer, and the lean industry has really screwed that one up. So let's just park that for another day, because this whole notion of what really is value-added and how we think about value-added needs to be challenged. So I got rid of this whole indirect. Now, it's not to say that we're indirect-direct ratio. It's not to say that the indirect, you can't put standard work in place and make that efficient. Sure, you can make that efficient as you can. But you don't just say we got to get rid of indirect labor, right? Variance analysis on direct labor, same thing, right? That didn't work. And piece rates, you got to, if you have piece rate in your company right now, it's one of the biggest problems for your quality. All right. So you got to get rid of piece rates. And then overhead variance analysis. Nobody ever understood what was in overhead. Overhead variance analysis, nobody could understand what was in a 246% overhead rate. It's like, what's in that number? Well, geez, you know, it's a lot of stuff, but nobody, even the accountants didn't understand it. Right. So we got rid of that garbage. And most of our overhead now was directly costed right to the product. Directly. Direct accountability. And I'll talk about that in a minute. Okay. I talked about capital appropriation requests. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, because I'd like you to go back to the podcast I did a couple podcasts ago about capital appropriation requests. I can't remember what number that was. I think it was 10. I could be wrong. Maybe it was 9. I'm not sure. But anyway, you can go back and look on the website, lean911.com. Lean911.com will look for the capital appropriation one. So I won't spend a lot of time on this, but, you know, the whole way we used to look at capital appropriation from a financial perspective was wrong. And I'll just say this, and there's a bunch of questions we have to ask about a new piece of equipment. And a lot of it ties into moonshining and 3P concepts that we learned from Shihiro Nakao. All right. But the one thing I will say about equipment is that we usually buy, engineers like to buy the new bells and whistles, and they like to buy battleships. And my mentor Nakao said, no, you need PT boats. And for those of you in foreign lands, a PT boat is a very small boat in the Navy. I don't know if they have them anymore, but you can maneuver. Just think about it as a rowboat. You can, or motorboat. You can maneuver a small boat a lot easier than you could do a battleship, right? Or a cruise ship. So he always said, don't buy battleships. Okay. Buy one operation machines to drive single piece flow. All right. And quick changeover and all the other things that go on here. So take a look at the CAR, or Capital Appropriation Request podcast. There's a lot of detail there, and we'll go into that, right? Okay, target costing. This is probably the most unsung part of what we did. We understood that 70%+ of your cost is built in and locked in and frozen in the design of the product. So what we did was we said, okay, well, we can't no longer, at least in our business, I think this is true for almost all businesses, you can't price your product based on your cost. Why does your customer care what it costs you? There's a market for your product. So if you say, well, geez, I'm going to charge $100 for a product when the market's sitting around, you know, 80, and you justify it because your costs are high and you're inefficient, well, guess what? You'll be 100% right with no business, because who would want to buy your product at 100 when they can get it for 80? All right. So this is a real dilemma. I've had CEOs tell me, oh no, Mark, we price on market. Well, why'd you lose the business? Oh, because our costs were too high. It just doesn't totally make sense at all. I've heard that told to me so many times before. It's like you knock your head against the wall after a while. So the old formula was, hey, whatever our cost is and our desired profit, that's going to be our selling price. That doesn't work. All right. The new formula says your selling price, which is market-based, minus your cost, the result will be your profit. Good, bad, or indifferent, that will be your profit. Now, I can affect cost by reducing it through lean, you know, methodologies. I can also affect selling price, believe it or not, even in the commodity business, because if I got better lead times and better delivery and better quality, then guess what? I can value sell. My sales guys can value sell the fact that we're a better product, even though we're making a commodity. And I have specific experience with this with one of our acquisitions that made a temperature controller in Brighton, England. And they were just a regular commodity product competing against big guys like Honeywell and Siemens. And we took their lead time from 28 days down to 3 days. The managing director at the time didn't believe me that we could do this, but we did. Competition was at 35. He thought he had a competitive advantage. He really didn't. When we took it down to 3 days and we were selling to distribution primarily, their GMROI, gross margin return on investment, how distributors measure themselves, where the biggest investment they have is inventory. They no longer had to carry a month and a half, 2 months of our product. They can carry maybe a week because our lead time was 3 days. Our volume went from 30,000 units a year to 110,000 units a year because of this one change. We're able to get some price out of it. So now the sales guys were able to take price off the table because we were a better supplier, right? Now, in design, target costing says, hey, as we're designing the product, and this is where my accountants became plant controllers, where they actually sat in these design teams and said, we need to take out a certain amount of cost. If a cost of a Jake break, the target cost was $600 to achieve our market-based margin, and the design's coming in at $700, we had a $100 design task that we identified as we went through every toll gate in the design process. And that spurred certain actions of the design and manufacturing teams to drive cost out. But you can't do that in a vacuum. You need your sales guys, your marketing guys. You need a full business look at the changes you make to the product, right? I made one as a CFO. I was looking at this one design, and they were going to drill a horizontal hole into a casting, and all of our bores were vertical. So we would have had to go out and buy a couple hundred thousand dollar piece of equipment just for this one design. I went back to the engineering group and said, by the way, why did you guys put this horizontal? And there was no apparent reason why they did. So like in 3 days, they came back with a vertical design, and we saved, you know, $200,000 of capital. It was as simple as that, right? So these are the kind of things that you do when you really drive and understand what's going on in the business. Target costing, I have not really seen this done well at all anywhere. And even in Danaher, I don't think we did a great job overall, but certain divisions did, right? So this is powerful, very powerful. And people think they do it, but they really don't know how to do this, okay? So more to it. Maybe I'll do a whole episode on this someday. We got rid of unnecessary reporting. We're producing a 30, 35-page cost report every month and went to 21 people. I knew nobody was reading it. So the September report in October, I took the September report, put the date of October on it, sent out the exact same report to 21 people. Only one person came back to me out of 21 and told me, hey, Mark, it's the same report from last month. And I said, well, geez, Bob, how'd you know? Well, that last page on that 35-page report, there's one number on it that I have to put into my president's report to George Conesacre, and the number was the same as last month. That's how I know. Well, but I don't know what that number means, he says. He just wants that number. And it was a closed order variance number, which was went away when we went to cell costing. And he said, I said, well, what about the rest of the report? No, I don't really look at it, he says. So then I asked everybody what they really needed to see, and we provided them online access to real-time data and some reporting that was much more streamlined, but much more meaningful based on the voice of the customer. See, nobody's going to come back and tell you that your reports are not needed, because it would be you have to have a lot of courage and confidence to be able to do that. What do you mean, my report? You're not using my reports? Oh, no wonder your performance is down. You're not using my data I'm giving you. 35 pages worth of unnecessary data, right? So nobody's going to come back and tell you it's not needed unless you ask them. So keep that in mind, because there's a lot of time spent on this garbage that you don't really have to, shouldn't have to spend time on. And your accounting resources can be deployed in a much more meaningful fashion, okay? And then we reassigned accountants to value streams. Okay. So I made these guys plant. I had three of them. I made plant controllers out of them. It looked good on the resume. They were getting more real controllership type experience, assigned them to design teams and business teams, which were businesses within businesses. They really were navigators. I got calls. Hey, where's Gary today? He's out. We need him in our meeting. You know, that type of thing. They did target costing and value stream costing and reporting, capital expenditures, as we talked about, product costing, cost improvement. It was a fun job for these guys, okay? And it wasn't just old mundane, green eye shade type accounting type of job that they were used to, all right? They were fun. And by the way, I moved my whole accounting team to the shop floor. Everybody was on the shop floor. I was right next to a automatic screw machine at the time before we got rid of them all. And I went there specifically because my father was a tool and die maker for 44 years, never missed a day of work in his life. Was actually at the Battle of Iwo Jima in World War II and Okinawa and all those battles. But anyway, he used to do tooling for screw machines, New Britain Gridleys. And this happened to be an Acme Gridley, but I thought it was fitting for me to put my desk right next to this machine. And I told my people that they can go anywhere they want on the shop floor. It didn't matter where they went. Go anywhere. Spread out. Right. Everybody loved it after a while, but one guy didn't like it. But he still came in with a suit and tie. But change is sometimes hard, right? But this was a fun job for these guys, and they had a blast doing it. And the businesses really appreciated our input into what was going on. You know, one of the things I think that I'll give you a couple quick stories. I had we assigned machine depreciation right to the shop floor. Okay. Anything that we can assign to a cell or to a value stream, we did. Now, there are certain costs that we couldn't assign, like it wasn't meaningful. For example, costs like building depreciation, insurance, security, building taxes, all these big overarching costs, which weren't a big play for the most part, but we would charge them out based on an ABC-based basis. So a lot of these costs, for example, I assign based on the square footage that you are using. So you had an incentive now to reduce your footprint. And at Jake Break, it worked because we ended up reducing our footprint by 50% and then grew the business from $60 million to, I think, we'll see the next chart, $240 million, okay? With the same headcount and the same floor space. Half the plant at one time was vacant. We had a basketball court on there. And by the way, the president of the company would be on the basketball team on Thursday night, so nobody was going to put inventory there. We had a volleyball court. We just had this thing wide open at the time. And then we obviously reclaimed that space once we started growing the business with the Asian business, which is the business I eventually took over, which was Hino Motors and Mitsubishi. That's what I drove when I went from my CFO position to operations. And anyway, so we drove the right behaviors. Well, one day, one of the operating guys came to me. His name was Bill. And he said, Mark, can you explain to me? I'm getting charged machine depreciation, and my machine depreciation per unit is X, whatever it was. Yeah, sure, Bill. Let's sit down and talk about it. So I explained the concept of depreciation and why I was charged to his cell, because he had 8 machines, and here's what this looked like. And I went through all the math. So he understood it. But then he said to me, Mark, I've got 8 machines here. I only need 6. I can re-engineer a couple of these things and reprogram. I don't need 8 machines. You mean to tell me if I get rid of 2 machines, my cost will go down? Yeah. Yeah. So I did the math, told him what that would look like. He told me the machines that he was going to, you know, eliminate. And he got rid of the 2 machines. I said, go put them over in the graveyard. We had an area in the shop, it was called the graveyard, where he had high-priced equipment that wasn't being used anymore. About a month later, a guy named Marshall, one of the managers, came up to me with a capital appropriations request. And he said to me, Mark, I'd like to have you look at this and improve it. I looked at it. I ripped it up right in front of him. He goes, Mark, what are you doing? I said, these 2 Matsura CNC machines are sitting over in the graveyard. Bill just put them over there. He got rid of them. They were 200, and with tooling, they were like $250,000 a piece. So call it $500,000, rough numbers. They're over there. You still have to justify this thing. You can't just go get them. You can't just go use them. But you still have to justify, but you don't need to purchase these things because we got them. Bill just gave up 2. Matter of fact, they're pretty new. So right there, the accounting system itself saved $500,000. Now, a couple months later, Bill comes up to me again. The same guy, happened to be the same guy. He's looking at these costs. I had it broken down. All the costs were broken down by tooling and labor and supplies and, you know, everything that went into machine depreciation and all this. And he had a very detailed listing of his cost per unit. And it was based on actual cost, by the way. It wasn't based on some standard. So anyway, he comes to me and said, Mark, my tooling costs went through the roof. What the heck happened? So I looked it up, pulled out the invoices and said, well, here you go. Well, Mark, I bought 6 months worth of tooling because I got a good deal on it. But, you know, you charged me all in 1 month. Don't you like amortize it across, you know, 6 months? I go, nope, not my accounting system. I don't. But isn't that accounting principles? Aren't you supposed to do it? Yep, you're supposed to do that. But not in my accounting system, not the management accounting system. Remember, I told you guys earlier that your management accounting system doesn't have to be GAAP compliant or Sarbanes-Oxley or any other regulation that's out there today. All right. This is it, Bill. I don't want you buying 6 months worth of tooling. What happens when the design changes and that tooling is no longer valid? Well, yeah, I guess that can happen. And Bill, why did you use cash, the company's cash, now to buy this stuff when you could have bought it? I said, look, go back to the vendor, negotiate a deal with him saying, look, he still got the deal, but we're not going to pay him for 6 months worth of tooling. But we'll commit to it on a blanket PO and we'll pull from it on a Kanban as you need the tooling. Okay. So he went back, and actually what he did was he sent back 4 months out of the 6. That's what he was able to do. But at least we got 4 months out of it. And see, you see what I'm trying to get at here is that you want to incent the right behaviors. He thought he was saving money by buying in volume. And at the end of the day, it would have hurt us probably more. It did hurt us more than not, right? Because you got to remember, you got to factor in the cost of capital when you now have to take that money he spent and borrow it with your cost of capital to fund something else in the business. This is why this is all very important. Now, when you look at inventory, some companies I've worked with, their cost of capital is 20% of the inventory value. So if you have $100 million, there's a real charge of $200,000 to your bottom line. Real numbers. It's not fake accounting numbers. Okay. So these are the kind of things that this cost system actually incented, okay, as far as the right behaviors. And I'll end with this, you know, our history with JakeBreak, going from year 1 when we started to year 10, we went from 65 million to 220 million with essentially the same headcount. It was a UAW shop. We went from $118,000 sales per employee to $383,000. And by the way, that's what price reductions. After Cummins pulled our inventory, the OEMs demanded price decreases. We kept the same floor space, 240,000 square feet. Our inventory turns went to north of 25. Our on-time delivery was 99% plus. To customer request date, not the promise date, to request date with a two-day lead time. Our productivity went from 3 kits per 100 man hours to 35. Our quality went to be less than 500 parts per million from 75,000. But that's still not good. I know that's not world-class, but what an improvement. Our new product development cycle went to 16 months from 72. And our EBIT went from what some people call operating profit, went from 4% on a downward trend, we're going to lose money, to greater than 30%. We were one of the better performing companies in Danaher. Okay, so that's the tail of the tape, if you will, as to what happened at this company called Jakebreak. Let me take a minute now to talk quickly about the things you're going to have to cover. And I'll be happy to answer any questions if you email me at mark@lean911.com. But these steps are very important when you convert over. Number one, you're going to have to reestablish your chart of accounts to reflect your new structure with your value streams and your cell design. Okay. And this is where you're going to charge direct costs into each one of these particular areas. So you have to recalibrate your POs. You have to convert your labor and your overhead. Your fixed assets have to be reassigned as to where they're being charged off now, as far as depreciation goes. You might have a situation where you share salary. So one engineer might cover a couple of different value streams, but we have to figure out what the best way is to just take that cost in your general ledger and charge it off once. I mean, so many times we spend time on nickel and diming that it doesn't matter at the end of the day. You're going to have to convert your purchase orders that are existing today and then make sure that future purchase orders are coded in accordance with your future value stream and cell design. You want direct materials costing. You're going to want to convert over to a backflush environment where you're not charging off all your inventory to point of use. Now, this is a tough one because if you have high inventory, you can't do this right away because you've got to capture the labor and overhead that's in work in process. But eventually you get to a point where you can just go backflush wall to wall, just like I described earlier. ABC costing I talked about already. That's another thing you have to consider for those things that just don't make sense to allocate on a cell or a value stream basis. Like, for example, electricity. You're not going to put your electricity chargers into or meters into every single cell, right? That makes no sense at all. So somebody have to figure out what the best way to do that is. And there's a number of different ways you can think about that. Your reporting, a value stream profit and loss statement. Why aren't your value streams, however you set them up? And you know, again, your value streams, we set them up by customer in this case. They can be set up by process. They can be set up by product family. There's a lot of different ways depending on the nature of your company as to how you would set these things up, right? You got your balance sheet and your cash flow. All these things should be thought of like factories within a factory, right? Companies within a company. You got your product costing and how you do that. That's a whole another endeavor as well. But you need that general ledger reconstruction if you're going to do that, right? And operational and KPI reporting. How about non-financial data? Inventory turns, quality, lead times. Safety, all these things, all these key performance indicators have to be baked into this whole reporting structure. It's not just financial, all right? So all these things are the things you have to think about. You know, I'm not spending a lot of time on each one of these, but they are things that you have to consider when you make this move, okay? And then you have to eliminate work orders. Now, I'm saying that in general, there are some businesses where that's not possible because of the regulatory and tracking that has to happen on like medical products and things like that. But bottom line is you want to get to a single flow environment, okay? Your work in process values, if you do this right, your work in process should go down considerably. So all the work that goes into tracking all that inventory should go away, which is where you would, on step three here, incorporate backflushing, as I talked about earlier. Okay. And then your inventory reporting, how do you look at inventory and how do you report it, right? And what does that mean? Because the notion of getting high on-time delivery with high inventory just doesn't work. Remember, again, Tayashi Ono once said, the more inventory you have, the less likely it is that you have what you need. All right. Went through that pretty quick, but these are the kind of things you have to think about. That's accounting for lean. I talked about in episode 11, lean accounting. They do go hand in hand. Email me with any questions about this. The hardest thing about doing what I just talked about is getting management understanding and commitment to do it, but more importantly, getting the finance folks to truly understand lean. Every one of them will tell you they do. I've had so many conversations with CFOs that say, no, you can't do this. Mostly they're CPAs. I'm a CMA, but they're CPAs, and their CPAs are just so beholden to the financial standards that they can't see the benefit of doing something like this. So remember, inventory was the biggest driver of warehouses. The accountant said, hey, I got this asset that's very volatile and it's very big on my balance sheet. So we need to put all these controls, checkpoint Charlie, and all these work orders, and we have to track a lot of that inventory management was driven by the accounting function because they didn't know how to control the inventory. So they imposed on the operations these archaic bureaucratic systems to track this thing called inventory. Okay. All right. I got that. But now we go to lean and the inventory comes down. I don't do this anymore. So to be able to use those old archaic processes and systems to track something that's inconsequential to your balance sheet is crazy, right? By the way, one more thing I want to talk about before I go, and this is a real case study. When you take inventory down, you're not generating favorable absorption variances anymore. So your costs on the shop floor are hitting your P&L right away. And, you know, you think about inventory, it comes out one of two ways. It comes out as a charge to cost of sales, or it comes out as a write-off for excess and obsolescence, right? That's the two ways it comes out. But you're not putting costs back into inventory because you're on a just-in-time basis. You're not building inventory anymore, per se. I'm not saying not building any inventory, but your fundamental batch and queue method on this is no longer, right? So what happens for an intermittent period of time when you're taking inventory down is you will have a negative profit and loss impact, P&L impact on your P&L. It will impact negatively your financial statement and your accounting performance. Those are accounting profits, okay? Accounting profits, believe it or not, it's what Wall Street looks at. It's how EPS is calculated. They've got all the reserves in there and all the amortization and depreciation and everything else that goes in there are not a good indicator, in my opinion, of the health of a financial health of a business. To me, the best indicator is cash flow. So when we started taking inventory down drastically at Jake Break and I was CFO, the Rails brothers, who were the two principal shareholders and started Danaher, and by the way, they're phenomenal people and really sharp businessmen, they came in to Jake Break, and they wanted to find out why our P&L was getting hit. Hey, God, you guys are doing all this great stuff with this, you know, Toyota production system. How come we're seeing these negative impacts on your P&L? All I had to do is show them the cash flow statement. And when I showed them that, they got it in like 5 minutes. They said, oh, got it. Okay. And this will soon go away and you'll start seeing these profits come back from an accounting perspective. But bottom line is we're generating a ton of cash because there's really a couple of ways that you can generate cash. One is, you know, spend less money on inventory and on capital expenditures. Okay. And make more money, make more gross margin in net income. That's the best way to generate cash. So as we're taking the balance sheet down, we're having favorable cash flow impacts by that. And there's a measure I use called free cash flow as a percent of net income. I'm not going to talk about that today, but if you want any information on that, let me know and I'll send that to you. Again, mark@lean911.com. Okay, just wanted to throw that out there because you will reface this when you transfer over and take inventory down. Even in a traditional accounting system, you'll have that negative P&L impact because your absorption variances in a very traditional cost accounting perspective will get hit. But that absorption effect still happens when you go to accounting for lean, except for you're just not reporting on absorption and looking at absorption as it's a good thing. Because that would incentivize you, if you believed in that, to build more inventory so your P&L looks good. That's not what we want to do, okay? Your P&L will take care of itself over the course of time, but there'll be an interim time where you take a hit in this regard. Okay. I just thought I'd mention that before we move on. So anyway, thank you very much for listening. Look forward to the next episode. Take care. Thanks for listening to the Lean 911 podcast. I'll be happy to address your questions or feedback on future episodes. Email me at mark@lean911.com. You can check out our other episodes by visiting our website at lean911.com, our YouTube channel, wherever you listen to podcasts. This is your host, Mark DeLuzio. Thanks for listening.